I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at Geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
On the Empire podcast this week, we'll be getting our totalitarian on with the dictator, storming an apartment building with the raid, talking Moonrise Kingdom with Wes Anderson, and learning about Men in Black 3 from Barry Sonnenfeld. Hello, the listeners. I'm Helen O'Hara, and welcome to the Empire podcast, your weekly dose of film news, interviews, reviews, and dodgy punning. Faced with the task of regime change and crime control this week, I've assembled a SWAT team of film reviewing talent. First up is Phil DeSemlin, Supreme Generalissimo of Arthouse and Foreignness. And yes, I'm mixing metaphors there. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you very much, Helen. Where's Chris?
Chris is in Cannes, thank you for asking.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Along with, I believe, your brother.
He's not my brother.
He's not.
As we've established.
You just
unrelated.
Share a very unusual surname and happen to work in the same office.
That's correct.
Nepotism.
It's a strange coincidence.
And today we also have, it's a small team today, we also have a special guest appearance from our very own Bruce Lee, Ollie Richards. Hello.
Hello.
Hey.
I'm kind of confused by being your very own Bruce Lee.
I was kind of trying to think of something that would kind of link to the raid but not be obvious, and I was martial arts. You know?
I'm okay with it. It just seems not very apt.
No. Well, it's not, I'll be honest. You have two arms and two legs and that's about it.
But I'm alive.
Well, a little bit soon, Ollie. A little bit soon. Now, all week you've been decanting your thought sherry into our comment goblets via tweets, Facebook messages and emails. I'm sorry, I didn't get away with that at all, did I? Anyway, let's take a look at some of this week's crop. At Cringe Radio asks, is there a Marvel character that you'd like to see get a movie who hasn't already? Now, we've really chosen the right guest for this today because we've got Ollie, I actively avoid comics, Richards, and Phil, I don't know anything unless it's in German, DeSemlin. So.
They've pretty much done all the ones I know of.
And you know of them because
they were in films.
Yeah.
I've read some comics. I've read approximately 7.
Oh, well, well done. Yep.
Well, you name some who should get their own films and I might know who they are.
I don't know, I quite like Scarlet Witch. I think you could do something interesting with her.
Yeah
I'm with that.
Oh,
that
wow, okay,
good.
Great. So there we go, Scarlet Witch, we're all on board.
Is there a Captain Azerbaijan?
There isn't, but maybe there's a space for that in the Marvel universe.
What about Ant-Man? Can I just say Ant-Man? Why am I even saying Ant-Man?
Are you possibly basing this on last week's chat with Edgar Wright?
I might be.
Okay. But, you know, we would like to see Ant-Man, I think it's fair to say. So, yes. Well done.
But that's my theory, that he actually was in the Avengers. We just couldn't really see him.
What? Because he was small?
Because he's tiny.
So he was just there.
So it was the smallest of cameos then?
Yeah, exactly. Oh dear.
That was a terrible pun. Ladies and gentlemen, Ollie Richards. At Adam of England asks, due to the success of Avengers, do you think DC will hit us with a Justice League movie and who would feature? Now, Ollie, you and I were discussing this just the other day.
On Twitter just yesterday. How
my
apt.
Goodness.
I wouldn't be surprised if it kind of comes back into being. I know there is the feeling that they would need to set up some more, like with Christian Bale finishing as Batman, they'd need to establish a new one and see how the new Superman does. But I can kind of see it working as almost an introduction to new characters. Mm. Like Marvel has taken the model of, we'll have the films and lead up to the big one.
Yeah.
But I think you could just as well do, here's the big one, and then we can use that to feed off onto other films.
Well, I mean, yes, possibly. I think it's a bit weird, this, because, you know, obviously they were talking about it a few years ago. It was George Miller, I think, was going to make it, and it was going to be kind of young Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, yeah, etc., kind of getting together as very, very young kind of college students and doing their thing from there, which would have gotten around the whole establishing everybody.
I don't
problem,
like that
I
idea.
Guess. I don't like that idea either, but I'm not sure how else you do it, because I think even watching the Avengers, actually, there were people clearly having a bit of trouble catching up on who the heck Mark Ruffalo was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of his jokes in the early part of the film fell a little bit flat in a couple of screenings I went to, because people clearly didn't quite get that he was the Hulk.
Right, okay.
And I think you might have the same problem if you're trying to set up some random newcomer as Bruce Wayne.
Maybe.
For example.
Maybe. I think the Superman and Batman thing would get people in.
Yeah, I get
that would be the complicated part. But I think if you were setting up people like The Flash, Wonder Woman, I think that's the right way to do them. Mm. Don't do the standalone one first. Test them out. Because, you know, with Hulk, he had two of his standalone films and they didn't work.
No.
And then they put him as part of something else and they kind of work out what works about him.
Yeah. Okay, so that... Yeah, I mean... I kind of feel like it could be done. I just feel like it's very difficult. I mean, the first X-Men movie, for example, found that it's quite difficult to introduce an entire world and entirely new characters all at once and give everybody some kind of character moment, give them something to do. And I think that's always the danger. When you throw in a bunch of characters in the first movie and you're introducing all of them, you end up having to spend like 90% of your time doing exposition, and it doesn't leave a lot of time for anything else. I mean, people complain that the first half hour of The Avengers is all scene setting. Imagine if it was the first hour. You know.
Yeah, true, but again, if you're scene setting with stuff people don't already know, then it's not so bad. I think The Avengers, if it is slow for the first half an hour, it's kind of a bit retreading over stuff that it's the catch up. It's previously on The Avengers. It could be done. I think it'd be complicated, but I can see it working.
If the writing's as good as Joss Whedon's was for The Avengers, then that exposition isn't a problem, because it doesn't feel like exposition.
Yeah,
I didn't sit there thinking, wow, The Avengers are coming together and here's all their backstories being played out, people that don't really understand the comic book world, and we're just waiting for the action to happen. I really, really enjoyed that. It was probably the bit of the movie I enjoyed almost the most, because it was just that well done and that smart.
I agree, but it has to be that well done, and I think that's the really
it does,
difficult.
And that's the challenge, really, I guess, for Justice League.
Yeah,
of course.
So, yes?
Yes.
What was the question?
Who would you like to direct if it were to be done?
It'd be obvious to say Joss Whedon, wouldn't it? No, I mean, honestly, I think it needs to be somebody who can really handle large groups, who can... cram in some character as well as some action. I mean, there's a really short list of people who could do that.
Mike Lee.
Alfonso Cuarón. Mike Lee. Not Mike Lee. No offence, Mr. Lee. Alfonso Cuarón, maybe he did a good job with Harry Potter. You know, we're looking forward to Gravity. That'd be interesting.
What about Guillermo?
Guillermo del Toro, he could add it to his list of 60 billion
things
to do. But yeah, I mean, he's obviously got you want a great storyteller, but also someone who can really handle a large group of characters and give them all something, give them all equal time. And I think that's a key.
True.
Okay.
Good question.
Yes, thank you, Adam. That was a good one. Phil Gowers asks, I found the Avengers movie cliched and predictable. Am I subnormal?
Yes, you are.
That's very a mean thing to say, Phil, but...
I didn't say it, he said it.
But certainly I would...
Phil, you're not, from another Phil.
Seek but professional help.
I'd say less... I don't agree with him, but I think subnormal would be unfair.
Okay, we're quite...
On an island of one, perhaps.
Jim Chilton asks, any news on when Richard Branson is to begin arranging commercial flights to LV-426?
Not as far as I'm aware.
Why would you want to go to LV-426?
Yeah.
That's like a terrible
Join
idea.
Us on a fabulous commercial flight to get killed horribly. By a savage alien.
Possibly. Oh. Aliens, TBC.
They've got to be there somewhere, right? Okay, Kieran Doyle asks, following the great Being Elmo, which film would be improved with a puppet in the starring role? And he immediately hashtags abduction. Taylor Lautner replaced by a puppet? My goodness. Any thoughts on that?
I mean, the question is, would you notice the difference, really, on that one?
Depends on the colour of the puppet, I suppose.
I can't think of any films that would be hurt by having a puppet in the starring role, but they would become very different films.
Mm. Lawrence of Arabia.
I'd watch it.
Apocalypto. Yes. Didn't the Muppets kind of do this with all of their pre-Muppets kind of teasers when they were doing, like, the Muppet with the Dragon Tattoo?
That's true.
Muppet with the Dragon Tattoo.
And they all worked.
And they were all very good, so all of them. Really.
So we've learned something.
All films should star the Muppets.
All films should star the Muppets. You heard it here first. Ray Pritchard asks, what was the first movie that you went to the cinema twice in the same week to see? He says his was Escape from the Planet of the Apes.
I saw Mission Impossible twice. in 1 week.
Okay.
I think I saw it 3 or 4 times at the cinema. It's the film I've seen most at the cinema.
Wow. I think mine's probably The Matrix, which I think I saw 6 times in Dole.
That's a lot of times.
At the cinema.
You saw it 6 times at the cinema?
I really liked The Matrix.
Well, no shit.
Yeah. And then The Lord of the Rings, I saw a lot of times each.
That's a lot of time to dedicate to the cinema, seeing all The Lord of the Rings.
Well, at that
times.
Point, I had a card for a certain cinema chain, which allowed me to go multiple times. So that was good.
And now you've seen The Avengers, what, 53 times?
Well,
in the
only
past
4, but I still need to get hold of an IMAX screening, so I probably will go back at least once more. Yeah, I know. Just, you're embarrassed to be seen with me. That's fine. Okay, and final question this week. Tom Wright asks, which fictional film universe would you like to live in?
Toontown.
Toontown.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
From Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yes.
That is a pretty awesome answer,
it's
I'll be
honest. It's obviously crime-ridden and corrupt, but yeah. It would be pretty cool.
Ollie, I think he might have just stolen your answer. I know that's one of your favourite films.
It is. It's my second favourite film.
After
Rear Window.
But you wouldn't want to live there, right?
No, you wouldn't, no.
What, in the allotment?
It's very crap.
Yeah, Grace Kelly high chance there. Of murder, so.
Where would I want to live? I don't know. Where do the Muppets live? I'd like to live there.
In the Muppets?
Yes.
Okay.
Just wherever the Muppets happen to be.
I'm not sure which I'd like. I'd quite like a fictional film universe where there's like magic or superpowers or dragons or something exciting, you know, as opposed to like offices and things. As long as I also had, you know, a toilet.
It's a lot of stress.
Right. Now, if you still want to get in touch with us after all of that and perhaps join the storied ranks of those whose messages have been read out on air, then just drop us a line. You can tweet us using the hashtag #EmpirePodcast, email us at podcast@empireonline.com or Facebook us at Empire Magazine. We are also willing to accept messages on scrolls of parchment hand-delivered by men in tights and a doublet, so that's also an option. Now, as ever, we'll be turning our gimlet gaze on this week's movie news, but first it's time for another listener-created jingle, and this one is from a mysterious figure known only as Manny, and we don't think it's the guy from Black Books, but, you know, it would be nice to think that it was. Here we go.
There's not a lot of jing in that jingle.
That was quite dramatic.
It's quite
dramatic.
Gritty and urban and dark.
Yeah, I feel
what
much more exciting
to,
now.
What happened to Melody Eel? Do you think he's in Cannes?
He hasn't sent anything in this week. We've got a new contributor. So Manny, thank you very much.
Thank you, Manny.
Do you think you can do better? We'd like to see you try. No, really, we would like to see you try. So send us your jingles or stings of no more than 15 seconds, please, to podcast@empireonline.com. Budding John Williams is out there. This could be your big chance. Right, now it's time to talk about this week's movie news. First up, I think, is a story from all our childhoods. Paddington Bear might be coming to the screen. Isn't that right?
That's correct. Helen, Paddington Bear is coming to the screen. Ooh. And the man behind it is Harry Potter producer David Heyman, who picked up the right to Michael Bond's book series about the bear from Darkest Peru, who finds his way through a variety of mishaps, trials and tribulations to Paddington Station and ends up living in West London.
Eating lots of marmalade.
Eating an awful lot of marmalade, giving people hard stares, getting into scrapes and mishaps. And David Heyman has hired Mighty Boosh director and the man behind Bunny and the Ball, Paul King, to direct this and write it.
And that sounds promising.
It's happening this year. And it's going to be a combination of live action with a CG bear, the harder things.
Yeah, because it's quite hard to get a small bear to wear Wellingtons and a duffel coat.
I would like someone to try, though. I kind of feel like I'm not the target audience for this film.
You are the target audience for this film, an interesting choice of director.
He's making it for
you. It is an interesting choice of director. It's not, I mean, his animation style, and we saw some of the cutout animation in Bunny and the Ball, was really influenced by Ivor Wood, who's the man that kind of brought Paddington Bear to the screen in our sort of childhood days.
In the TV series, which was sort of 2D animation.
Exactly. It was kind of, I think the bear was 3D and everything behind him was 2D.
Yeah.
Sort of
and
it line was, drawings. And
exactly,
things.
Line drawings. It was a combination of stop frame animation and paper cutouts. That's not going to be the look of this film.
Okay.
But hopefully some of that kind of aesthetic will filter through. And it certainly did in Bunny and the Ball.
Yeah.
So he's got, I think it's, you know, if you love Mighty Boosh, like a lot of people do, it's going to be, he's got a quirky, should we say, idiosyncratic kind of sense of humour, which I think will fit in pretty well with Paddington Bear in a weird way. It's a little bit like trying to imagine Wes Anderson's Fantastic Mr. Fox. And somehow,
that
like, from
turned out well.
Different poles, they kind of coalesced into something really cool, and the spirit of the two seemed to gel. And I think that this might be the same thing. I remember Paddington as... You know, it's a fish out of water story, I guess, isn't it? Like, he's in London, and I gather they're still writing the books. They've sold something like 35 million of them. So they're kind of beyond Twilight in terms of popularity.
No, surely not.
But apparently Paddington fans aren't quite as fanatical as Twilight fans. So that's some reassurance to Paul.
That would help a little bit. It reminds me, weirdly, of the Winnie the Pooh that Disney brought out last year, because that was, on one hand, very traditional and very faithful to the Winnie the Pooh books, and on the other hand, was quite surreal in a weird way and quite bizarre, because Winnie the Pooh and friends interacted with the text of the books as if there were pages turning, and they would sort of hang off letters and use the letters in the books to make a ladder and things like that. And I'm not saying this will be that way, it won't be done the same way, but it just feels like it might have a bit of the same kind of gentle whimsy to it.
I'm sure it will, and I think Paul King is very, you know, and David Heyman as well, very keen to sort of cleave closely to the spirit. So there's going to be marmalade sandwiches under his hat. It's going to be a Peruvian bush hat. He's going to have a duffel coat.
Do you think it's difficult to make this kind of thing charming if you're putting CG in with live action? Like the ones who said are successful, like Fantastic Mr. Fox and Winnie the Pooh, all animation. And then you can be a little bit weird with that. But when I think CG animal character put in with live action, Garfield comes to mind.
Say that again.
I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm just saying it's much more difficult to make a bit of CG charming.
Possible, but then you've got Babe, which had a bit of CG, actually.
Only on his mouth, I believe.
Well, yeah, but around the place, the mice and things.
No, they were real talking mice.
Okay.
Do you think they should bring in, like,
if anyone knows the best way to let Ollie down on that, do get in touch. I'm not gonna destroy his illusions. You should see his little face.
I'm sure if Werner Herzog was directing this film, they'd bring in an actual bear and just dunk it in portobello, see what happens.
I want to see that one.
They'd probably just replace him with a large lizard instead.
Through West London. I know, I take your point. I mean, but I think that with a good story and a good script, and, you know, a certain fidelity to this character that everybody loves so much, that will be, you know, avoid the pitfalls that Garfield certainly had.
Okay, and how about the rest of the news this week? There's been movement on El Presidente, hasn't there?
Yes, which has apparently been around for a couple of years, but I can't say I remember it. But it's back in the news this week because there's potential casting change. It's about a bodyguard who is defending a sleazy ex-president.
Ooh.
And the bodyguard is probably still being played by Tom Cruise, who was mooted originally.
Yep.
But the sleazy president has possibly changed from Jack Nicholson to Robert Downey Jr.
Ooh.
Yes, so I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
And Jay Roach is supposed to be directing. So I think there's a lot of elements in that could work a lot.
Yes. Robert Downey Jr. as a sleazy ex-president, I think we'd be on board with. I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still not certain. I mean, none of these are official yet. They're apparently being discussed. And it's not known which role Tom Cruise would take and which one Robert Downey Jr. would take. And I could see either working.
Yeah, it would be quite fun to kind of play against type and have Tom Cruise as the sleazy guy, which he's kind of playing this summer in Rock of Ages in a rock star way. Take a little bit of that. Make it a bit presentable.
He's good at that.
Halfway between Rock of Ages and Lions for Lambs.
And he's done Tropic Thunder as well, so I think he's kind of shown.
And he's pretty sleazy in Magnolia, you'd have to say.
So he can do sleaze.
So he can definitely do that.
Okay.
I just think that's a great combination of people. Yeah. I'll watch pretty much anything those two want.
Have they played
together
before?
Tropic Thunder.
Good point.
They didn't share a screen, but they were both there. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those A-list combinations where you're like, of course, why have we not seen this before?
Yeah.
So I think, that sounds promising. Like, we'll keep an eye on that as it goes forward. Also heard confirmation this week that Julianne Moore is going to join the remake of Carrie. So she'll be playing the Piper Laurie role in the original, the mother to Chloe Grace Moretz's Carrie. So that's, I think, again, good news.
Yeah, excellent news. Yeah.
It is great news. And again, it's kind of interesting to see her play that role, because that character is... I don't even know if I'm allowed to say batshit demented, but she's insane.
She's demented.
Yeah, properly insane. And I don't think we've seen Julianne Moore playing someone quite as out there before.
Not to that level that I can think of, but I think that's great casting.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, even though the original is a classic, I think it's kind of ripe for a remake anyway. Mm.
It'll be, as long as they take a slightly different approach and give us like their own spin, I think it could be a good thing. So, yay for Julianne Moore.
Yes.
Yay for Carrie.
Well done, Julianne Moore.
Okay, well done, you guys. And also this week, in the least surprising news the world has ever seen, The Avengers has broken $1 billion at the worldwide box office in 19 days, equaling the record. And that's with only 12 days release in the US, which is pretty terrific. I think, honestly, the important thing here is that it does better than Transformers Dark of the Moon. And I think if it does that, even if it stays behind Avatar and Titanic and Harry Potter up there, that will be okay, because we'll have kind of struck a blow for not being rubbish.
Yes.
And making lots of money.
Yes.
I think that would be good.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of pretty much dead on to be the biggest of the summer. I can't see anything, even Batman, I can't see surpassing that now.
Well, we'll have to see. But yeah, it's looking good. Okay, before we get on to this week's reviews, we also had a recent visit from director Barry Sonnenfeld, who's the man who brought us 1 Get Shorty, 2 Addams Families, and now 3 Men in Blacks. So here's what he had to say about his latest return to Ray-Bans and Sharp Suits.
Could you tell us the story of how this film happened? Because it is a long one. It's been more than a few years in the making, and even the actual process, the production, has been complicated, shall we say. So how did Men in Black 3 happen?
I was on the set directing Men in Black 2 in 2001. It was 4 a.m. We were in L.A. It was cold. It was dark. And I was tired. But then there's this ball of energy, which is Will Smith, who comes in, sits down right next to me. He calls me Baz, B-A-Z. He goes, "Hey, Baz, I got the plot for Men in Black 3. Now, remember, we're on Men in Black 2 still shooting. He says, "I got the plot of Men in Black 3. Here it is." The movie opens up, and like Men in Black headquarters is destroyed or something, and I can't find Tommy Lee Jones's character, you know, Kay. I can't find Kay. I look everywhere, and I realize that a villain has jumped back in time to some previous era, and I've got to travel back in time to save Tommy Lee Jones's character. And in doing so, I and the audience find out things that we never expected about everything. And I looked at Will and said, "Can we just finish this one?" And that was 2001. Now it's 2012. Men in Black 2 had come out. Many years have gone by. And we realized that we wanted to sort of reinvent the franchise. We knew what worked, which was a relationship between Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones. But we felt that by adding time travel, going back to, as it turns out, 1969, having young Agent K, we could sort of both have the best of the old and recreate the franchise.
Some critics said of Men in Black 2 that it used a lot of the beats of Men in Black 1. It kind of played around.
Right.
Were you conscious of not doing that for the third one?
We all felt that although Men in Black 2 had some good things about it, that ultimately we were disappointed in it, and that here's what went wrong. First of all, we thought the Men in Black franchise was a comedy, and it really isn't. It's really about relationships. It's about other things. And that Men in Black 2 was just too funny. We went back to the well too many times. There's too much Frank the Pug and Jeebs. And so we very specifically wanted to make sure we weren't doing another caper, another just someone comes to Earth and tries to destroy it and our guys save the day. And in addition, we also felt we didn't have a particularly good villain in 2. We had a combination of Johnny Knoxville and Laura Flynn Boyle, but there was no... Your heroes are only as heroic as your villain is mean. And after Vincent D'Onofrio in the first one, we felt that we had laid off a little bit too much on villain. So all those things were reasons why in Men in Black 3, you only see Frank the Pug in one shot. You don't see Jeebs. You know, we didn't want to go back to that same well of jokes again.
What's the process like when you finish a film like Men in Black 2, and you know it did really well at the box office? Critics didn't really warm to it in the same way that they did the first film. Do you kind of forensically go through and think about the things that didn't work, and you know, listen to what audiences are saying, and kind of work that into the treatment for the next one? I mean, this was 10 years ago, so
right.
I guess the ideas kind of evolved quite a lot since then. But is that in your mind always when you're a filmmaker?
The truth is, at least in my case, a good filmmaker already knows what's wrong with their movie or what works for their movie. You still learn things while you're showing the film to recruited audiences, because usually wherever you think the problems are when you're making the movie are not. But by the time you're done, you know what went wrong, what went right. And, in fact, what happened with me is I directed a movie called Get Shorty a long time ago, and it got very good reviews, and I started to read the reviews. And I said to my wife, who I call Sweetie, "Hey, Sweetie, listen to this." And she stopped me and she said, "If you read and validate the good reviews, you have to read and validate the bad reviews. So do you want to read reviews?" And after that first review on Get Shorty, which was a good one, I stopped reading reviews and haven't read a single review. Now, having said that, I happen to know, in spite of reading reviews, that Men in Black 2 is not well received. But the way everything that was wrong or right with Men in Black 1 or Men in Black 2, I knew because I made the movies. So, and, you know, Will and I talk about that a lot. And Will Smith and I made sure we knew what was working for the franchise and what we didn't want to go back to again.
Yeah.
You talked earlier about, you know, having a big bad. So, Jermaine Clement, was it a case of you watching Flight of the Conchords and going, you know what, I'm going to make him an absolute animal. I'm going to turn him into a big monster.
No one looks at Jermaine Clement in Flight of the Conchords and says, there's a badass mother who's going to really be the ultimate villain. Yet, Jermaine is incredibly good in the movie, and here's what happened. And he's a really good villain. The producer, Walter Parks, had been working with Jermaine on Flight of the Conchords, and on Dinner for Schmucks, and said, you should meet Jermaine. I think he's great. He's a great improvisational guy. Well, the funny thing is, Men in Black has never been improvisational. We don't, like, show up on the set with cameras and say, guys, pretend like you're, like, angry and having a horrible dinner together. You know, it's all worked out ahead of time. But in spite of that, I met Jermaine. He's tall. He's got the deepest voice of anyone I've ever met. And I knew he'd be great. And we got him into 5 hours every day of Rick Baker makeup. So part of, I think, what allowed him to be so mean was getting up at 2 a.m. and showing up to the set for 5 hours of makeup. And what's very funny is Jermaine has a very thick New Zealand accent. And I love Flight of the Conchords. Just love it. But when I would sit and have dinner, just myself and Jermaine, I literally could not understand a word he was saying because it's so thick. So because I'm bossy and I'm the director, I told Jermaine whenever we were together, whenever we were having any meetings or dinner, he had to only speak in a high British accent. So I would have dinner with Jermaine at a New York City restaurant, and it would sound like I was having dinner with Queen Elizabeth.
Some of my favorite bits in the first two films, and also in this one as well, are the big screens with people's faces on them. And I remember pointing at the screen when Steven Spielberg and Sly Stallone are on the big screen. How does that happen? Do you have to ask permission, or do you just put them up?
You know, in all three Men in Blacks, one of the things we have is at the headquarters, we have this surveillance screen where you see who are truly aliens, and we have to keep surveillance on them. I think also Michael Jackson was in the first one, Lucas and Spielberg. In the second one, Martha Stewart was in it. So you have to ask permission. And in this one, there were several funny incidents. There's Justin Bieber. My main reason, most people think it's because he's sort of young and so successful, I think it's because he's Canadian. I have a theory about Canadians. There's a reason why they're, like, more lovely than anyone else and kind. And if you've spent time in Canada, their homes and apartments almost look like what real homes and apartments look like. But it's 3% off. So my theory is that aliens took lots of photos of America, sent it to their native planet, but in transmission, 2.3% got garbled. So the aliens came down, inhabited upper North America. Anyway, back to the surveillance. I never thought Tim Burton was an alien. I think he knows other aliens. He may have several children with an alien, so they keep surveillance on him to see what aliens he's hanging out with. But Tim was very willing to be in it. We also had to give all the aliens alien names and real names, so Lady Gaga's alien name is Lady Gaga.
Hiding in plain sight.
Hiding in plain sight. And Barbara Streisand, which she's on very shortly, but she was on it and she said, I need a name. So the name I made up was Babs of Newtonia. And I get an email, I can't accept that name. Okay, why? Because the word Newt is too close to Newt Gingrich, who's an American politician, and she wanted to make sure she was not supporting his cause because he was running for president at the time. So there's a lot of intricacies. It's amazing we're still not working on Men in Black 1 at that level of sort of detail that you have to go through.
And I think it's just a throwaway gag, and I just think, oh, they just put up Sly's image. Nope.
Nope. Yeah. All requested, all lawyers, you know, you go through a lot. Beckham.
This is why it took 10 years to make. I'm just trying to get Barbara Streisand to respond to her emails.
Right. I think that the next one, we may have to just do away with surveillance. Yeah.
Is it true, you mentioned Michael Jackson, and I know that he was a big fan. Mm-hmm. Is it true that he watched the first Men in Black and was quite emotional, overawed, and then you spoke to him about potentially appearing in the second one?
I wasn't there, but I hear he loved the first Men in Black, was desperate to be in the second one. I did not approach him. He approached Sony and said, I think he basically said, if you want my next album, I must be a Men in Black. I mean, he really, wow, really was using whatever power he had at Sony to be in Men in Black. And I thought it would be great if he were an alien, but he wanted to be an agent. So he said, I've got to wear the black suit. So we made him an agent in training. We shot him against blue screen on the set. And if you remember the movie, we then, in post, I'm trying to decide where he should be. And I decided Antarctica. So there's icebergs. And he never knew he was in Antarctica. When we were shooting, no one knew. But, you know, post-production can be a long and boring process. And I said, yeah, let's find some photos from Antarctica.
You mentioned the tone and bringing out the comedy by kind of not forcing it and not trying to make it funny. And I kind of wonder, because tone is so difficult to master, especially when you're kind of between genres in a way that, say, Tim Burton's Dark Shadows was. Adam's Family, did you tackle that in the same way? Was it kind of, you know, letting the comedy come out kind of organically and getting your cast to act it pretty straight throughout? Or
Yeah, you know, I grew up with the Charles Adams drawings from the New Yorker magazine. I was not a fan necessarily of the television show, but his drawings were very dark, very macabre, and also very much like my philosophy about movies. He didn't show you where the joke was. You kind of had to figure it out on the page. When we cast Adam's Family, we didn't cast any comedians, Raul Julia, Angelica Houston. And in fact, with Angelica, because she hadn't done comedies before and thought she needed to be funny, my direction to Angelica was always flatter, don't comment on the joke, just, you know, you're not trying to be funny. And she got it. But her instinct, because she hadn't done comedies, knew it was a comedy, was to go towards comedy. So my direction to everyone on that movie, although no one was flatter or needed any direction less than Christina Ricci, who sort of like was born to play, you know, Wednesday Addams. But so for me, very much so, don't cast comedians. And if you do, you never want more than one funny person in your movie. You get two funny people in your movie, it's disaster. Always stick with one.
I mean, you're talking about not having too many funny people in one film. You had Wild Wild West, where you had...
You read my mind.
Yeah.
Please go on.
You got Kevin Kline twice, if I remember correctly.
Again, Will Smith and Kevin Kline, who's going to be the straight man?
Yeah.
And it's funny you ask that, because originally the movie was designed where Kevin Kline's character was a straight man and Will was the funny guy. That's the way it was designed. You only want one funny guy. You only want George Burns and Gracie Allen. You don't want two Gracie Allens. It's not going to work.
Be a nightmare.
Be a nightmare, and they'd still be talking. And early on, Will Smith and I realized that Kevin was not going to be the straight man. That everything about Kevin's sort of instincts and desires were leading him towards being the funny guy. And throughout rehearsals, I just couldn't get him to be the other one. And Will, who exactly shares my philosophy, looked at me one day after rehearsals and said, "Hey, Baz." And I said, "I know what you're going to say, Will." And he says, "Yeah, it looks like I'm the straight man on this one." So we literally changed sort of the plan.
Yeah.
Many things went wrong with that movie, but one of the biggest things, which doesn't go wrong with Men in Black, is the audience felt no chemistry between Will and Kevin. The audience instantly feels chemistry between Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones, and you could not have, at least if you were writing down attributes on paper, two more different people. Mm-hmm. Same with the chemistry between Josh Brolin and Will. We were very worried, Will and I. The only way we could screw this movie up is by not having Tommy Lee Jones in two-thirds of the movie and replacing him with someone that makes the audience go, "Wait, you guys had a formula that was working, and now you screwed it up by bringing some guy in and not Tommy?" The brilliance of Brolin is the audience just thinks, "Oh yeah, now we're watching younger Tommy Lee Jones." There's no like disconnect, and you literally forget all that, and you just think you're watching Agent K, old Agent K, young Agent K. Mm-hmm. They just happen to be played by different people, but it's the same character.
Men in Black 3 will be out next Friday, so we'll be reviewing that in next week's podcast. Now, the chance to win something cool. Yes, do the dance of joy, people, because it's competition time. Last week, we offered you the chance to win all four seasons of True Blood on Blu-ray, and we had a flood of entries, but the lucky winner was Victoria Thompson. So, Victoria, congratulations. This week, we have five copies of the fantastic The Descendants on Blu-ray also, which is out from 20th Century Fox on Monday, May 21st. So, to be in with the chance of winning one of these, you need to tell us the name of George Clooney's character in ER, his big breakout role. What was the character he played? Just send us your answers to podcast@empireonline.com, and we'll let you know if you've won this time next week. And that is a film worth winning, right, guys?
Yes, it is.
I know the answer. Can I enter?
No, you can't tell
the
answer.
That's disappointing.
Sorry. I know you're just trying to be helpful. Now, before we get on to this week's reviews, we have time for one more quick interview, and this one is extremely exciting. We spoke to Indie Guru and director Wes Anderson about his new film, Moonrise Kingdom, which is screening this week at Cannes, and here's what he had to say.
So, Wes, thanks very much for joining us. How are you doing?
Very good. Thank you for having me.
So, Moonrise Kingdom is set in the 60s, and it involves Boy Scouts. Where did the story come from?
Well, the story came from I wanted to make a movie that was about a romance between two 12-year-olds, and I would say kind of inspired by the François Truffaut movie Small Change that's about a world of children, their world, and thinking of some things in my own experience how powerful some emotions and experiences at that age are. And I remember how when I would be in the middle of reading a novel that I loved, I would almost lose a sense of what is reality and what is the book, and that sort of desire for fantasy. Those are some of the things that I wanted to kind of get into this movie.
Now, there's Troop 55. In the movie, which I googled, and apparently there is a Troop 55 in Houston, Texas, which is where you're from. Is that a coincidence? Or
no, it's not.
Talk about your scouting experience if you haven't.
Well, I was just briefly in that troop, but I probably it's probably not even legal that we use Troop 55. I said no one has ever mentioned it to me. I guess I probably didn't tell anybody but a number should be public domain. Whether I happen to have been in Troop 55 at one time, whether that is true or not.
We might have to libel, take this bit out of the podcast. So how adept are you at scouting? Would you be able to survive in the woods?
Well, I like to think of myself as a survivor per se, But I will admit that my scouting skills are largely untested, and there are limits. However, I would say Edward Norton, on the other hand, and I don't know if Edward ever was in the Scouts or not. I don't think he was, but Edward could take the. You know what an Eagle Scout is? Eagle Scout, American Scouts. That's the epitome of scouting. That's the highest rank that you can achieve. And you know, somebody who's graduating from high school in America and they happen to be an Eagle Scout, that's considered, you know, something of an honor. Even among people who make fun of scouts. Edward, if he's not an Eagle Scout, he could be. He's very capable in the wild.
So he would be a good guy to go camping with.
Definitely.
Okay.
He'd know how to handle everything. On top of that, he's a pilot. He could, you know, he could fly you out of there if you get in real trouble.
Would Bill Murray be a good guy to go camping with, do you think?
Yeah, well, Bill's actually very. Bill's is similar. Bill, they share something, which is they're the kind of guys where if you ask them a question, they'll usually give you an answer. They're not really particularly guys who can't think of anything to say. And Bill is Bill's the kind of person who knows how to take care of himself, and that's the kind of person who usually take care of everybody else too, should it be necessary.
So how was the actual experience of shooting this film? Because you obviously did Fantastic Mr. Fox beforehand, which imagine you were cooped up in a studio making that. And this film is outdoors and in some amazing locations. Was that a freeing experience?
Yeah, well, making Fantastic Mr. Fox was very fun. A long process, all the phases of filmmaking happening at once, but it was, you know, a chance to just be adding things and inventing things for the story continuously for a long period of time. And so it was actually not a feeling of being stymied in any way. It was very exciting, and I really kind of walked away from the movie, not only having a great experience making the movie, but with all sorts of things that I, sorts of new techniques and sort of systems that I used as we made this film. But it was great to be able, for the first time in some years, to be on a set with a group of actors and spontaneously bringing scenes to life, having them bring the scenes to life. And it was also very nice to make a film in America because I hadn't done that in many, many years.
And you've assembled another incredible cast, and it's kind of an assembly of some people you've worked with many times before and some great new fresh faces for you. Can you talk us through who plays who?
Yes, well, we have the two main characters are, there's Sam Shukusky and Susie Bishop. They're played by Jared Gilman and Kara Hayward, who are both people who had met, they're students, they're middle school students. They don't have any experience doing this, but they were both wonderful. And then the rest of the cast is, we have Bruce Willis, who plays the island police captain of this little township. We have Edward Norton as the scoutmaster who leads the troop that that Sam Shukusky, that Jared's character Sam, is a part of. We have Frances McDormand, who's the mother of the girl, Susie, and Bill Murray, who's her husband, who's the father of the girl. They're Mr. and Mrs. Bishop. They're attorneys. And then we have...
Harvey Keitel.
We have Harvey Keitel, uncredited, as the commander of all the scouts. We have Tilda Swinton, who plays a character called Social Services, who is just that. And Jason Schwartzman, who is who is sort of like one of those black marketeers of a war movie, but it's for a scout camp.
It took me a while to recognize him, actually, at first.
Jason, yeah, with his mustache and his sunglasses.
How was it working with Bruce Willis? Because I've just read the new Kevin Smith book, which he dedicates a whole chapter to describing how difficult he found the experience of working with Bruce.
Right.
I take it that wasn't your... experience.
No, I love working with Bruce. I haven't seen what Kevin Smith reports, but Bruce was great, and he was, you know, when I had this idea to approach him, I don't know, it's a long shot whether Bruce would want to do this. I met him very briefly before, I didn't know him, and I thought this character would be quite different from anything we've seen him do. He's quite a sad, lonely, reserved person, but he's also a policeman. And if there's anybody who you're going to believe, he's the real thing, and he carries a badge, I think Bruce Willis. And he really, I felt quite transformed himself, and he was a wonderful part of our company. I had a great experience with Bruce.
I remember you saying with Fantastic Mr. Fox that you got everyone out into the forest to before you did the voices to get everyone kind of bonding.
Yeah.
Was that the case here? Did you all go out in the woods and, or anything like that?
Well, it was Mr. Fox. We all went out in the forest and we recorded them, and those voices are in the movie. With this, we all, you know, there are scenes where the boy and the girl are sort of trekking, and you know, they're making their way through the wilderness, and those scenes we tried to make as much like a documentary as we could. We prepared them quite a bit. We went and actually shot some of these scenes without the kids in them, with just playing the parts ourselves to find how we wanted to stage them. But then we went out with five very small cameras, the size of each one's like the size of a shoe, and a very small group, and we tried to enact the journey, and that's how we made the scene.
And you asked Jared to watch the Clint Eastwood movie Escape from Alcatraz, I believe.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
Any other films that were kind of touchstones for Moonrise Kingdom?
I told him to watch Escape from Alcatraz because I wanted him to think of himself as Clint Eastwood, which is not like the first thing that would jump into your mind if you meet him personally. I did screen a film for the cast called Black Jack. That's a Ken Loach film. That's one of the inspirations for this. And there's another film called Melody. Have you heard of that one? They're both British films. Melody is also an inspiration for this movie, and written by Alan Parker, his first anything, and directed by Waris Hussein, a very good director. And those two were maybe the key ones.
It also made me think a little bit of the Pixar movie Up, which has obviously, you know, it's a very different couple, but it has a Boy Scout, and they go on that journey and kind of discover
themselves. Yes,
are you a
right.
fan of that movie?
Yes, I like that movie, yeah. Well, you know, that was our adversary when we did Fantastic Mr. Fox. Every award ceremony that I went to, we got to go and watch them win it. I like, you know, I'm a Pixar fan. I like their whole body of work.
And I wanted to ask more generally, your work is steeped in other films. Do you see everything at the cinema when it comes out? And what kind of films are you looking forward to seeing this year?
I don't see everything when it comes out. I'm just off the top of my head, I'm looking forward to the Odiard film, the Jacques Odiard film, because I loved the last one, En Prophète.
There was a British film by Richard Ayoade called Submarine which Stella produced.
I love Submarine.
All the reviews said, you know, this movie is Wes Anderson-esque, while being its own thing. You did enjoy it?
I very much, yeah. I think I thought it was wonderful.
And what have you got coming up next? Are you taking a break?
I'm just working on a script for something, a movie that I would like to make in Europe, but I'm just beginning.
And what do you do when you're unwinding, when you're not on a film set?
I don't do relax. That's not really my sensei. That's not something I feel often. I will say that one of my things I'm most fond of doing is going out to dinner. I like to go, you know, I like to go to the theater, and in London especially. Then just the usual things you would expect. I like to watch movies, I like to read, and I like to work. Mm-hmm.
And just as a final question, I'm a huge Bill Murray fan, and there's obviously the legend that to get to, in contact with him, you have to call his voicemail and leave a message, and he'll call you back. Was that the case with you, or how did you first?
No, when I first got to know Bill, he had an agent. So his agent helped us, you know, get our script to him, and that's how it was arranged. But I do remember the first time I spoke to Bill was we had sent our script. You know, we'd given the script to the agent. This was for Rushmore, and everything I had heard was that probably we'll never hear anything, and this is just going to disappear. And then I was in the office. For some reason, a rare occurrence, I was at Disney in the office of the executive that was in charge of our film. Donald DeLine is his name. And the phone rang, and they said, we have Bill Murray for Wes. How he had located me in Donald DeLine's office, I have no idea. And Donald DeLine said, take my desk. And he left the room and everybody else left, and I went behind the vice president in charge of production's desk, and I spoke to Bill Murray for a solid hour he was talking about a Kurosawa movie that the script had reminded him of, Redbeard, which is a Kurosawa movie about a doctor in kind of samurai territory, say a period. It was a strange connection, but interesting. And he was just talking about how it had worked dramatically. And then at some point, you know, he said, "Well, all right." And I was so. Is this like you want to be in it, or what is the thing? Is it, yeah. Okay, good, great. So, and that was more or less in the conversation.
What did you do when you put the phone down? That must have been.
I told him he's in. He wants to play. We need to get Redbeard. Research to do. And then I think maybe I met him a week later.
Fantastic.
At last, it's time to roll out the red carpet for this week's reviews. First off, we're off to Indonesia via Wales for The Raid, which is directed by Gareth Evans and stars Iko Uwais. I think it's fair to say that we're a little bit excited about this one, isn't it?
Yes, completely. It's terrific. But I really hope it's not one of those films that is hurt by the hype and expectation before, because it completely came out of nowhere.
Yep.
I don't think anyone was expecting the action film of the year to come via Wales and Indonesia.
No.
But it's just terrific. I think there's nothing to dislike about it. Mm. It's the simplicity of the idea,
yeah,
and then just perfect execution. It's so imaginative in every action sequence it has. I don't even want to talk about any of them because it will spoil them. But there's just so many brilliant moments in there using various household objects, and then just feet and arms,
knees and elbows.
Yeah.
The whole thing. Just to clarify, the plot is that basically a SWAT team are sent in to take an apartment building which is controlled by a drug dealer. He's got petty criminals basically living in the whole building, so the SWAT team has to fight their way past everybody.
Yeah, everybody, and it really is everybody. There's almost no end to the action in here. And it's kind of interesting, it's now the first part of a trilogy, which is, I mean, it's a good idea. I hope they remain at this level. Be interested to see where it goes, because it is so simple. It's not setting up some enormous epic, it doesn't seem.
Well, there's some threads at the end that could go on, but we won't say what those are.
Yeah, it's difficult to talk about where it might go without giving too much away from the end of this one. But I think Outside might not be giving too much away. It's this sort of film is, I think, ferociously difficult to make because they're indoors all the time. I think Gareth Evans was saying that, you know, they were coming into work at 5 in the morning, leaving at 11 p.m. every single night, not seeing daylight for the entire duration of the shoot, and basically sort of kicking the crap out of each other. And it's unbelievably visceral and in your face. You literally come out like nursing bruises just watching it.
There were several fight scenes with the audience I saw it with, and again, this is a bunch of hardened critics who don't, you know, they don't do anything in films. You get a lot of critics who just sit there and don't laugh, they don't cry, they don't do anything. It's terrifying. But this group burst out laughing at the end of several different fight scenes just from sheer release of tension. They couldn't believe how uptight they'd been during the scene. And one fight in particular near the end of the film, there was a huge round of applause.
There were elements I wondered if they'd sped it up. It was so... What they could do was so ridiculously quick and complex. It just... Amazing. I'd like them to go to the valleys of Wales next.
That would be a true crossover. Swansea.
This would work in a small village in Wales, in the Brecon Beacons.
Yes.
I think this would work anywhere. The action was just completely astonishing. So what we're trying to say then is that we want people to be really excited about it and go see it, but not be hyped about it to the extent that they're looking for flaws.
Yeah. Totally.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's difficult. When we've given it 5 stars and we all love it, just to say, but like Ollie says, you don't want to over... It's too late.
We've oversold it.
Shit, the fire extinguisher. It is that good, though. It's like nothing we've really seen for a long time. And if you love films like Die Hard, this is kind of like Assault in Precinct 13, isn't it? There's John Carpenter. There's Jackie Chan. There's Bruce Lee. There's John Woo. There's Tony Jaa. There's just all of those like high octane film stars and filmmakers have informed this movie.
Important to point out, they're not in it.
No,
but
it's not the Avengers of like martial arts. They're not in it, but they've certainly influenced Gareth, and I think he wears that on his sleeve. But at the same time, he's got fresh ideas, and the scenes are so jarring and so in your face in a very unique way. And also, he's introduced silat, which is a new form of new for Western cinema, Indonesian martial art, mixed martial art, which is more. He was explaining more graceful, but then full on when they start fighting. There's not really any of the graceful... I couldn't spot any of the graceful bits in this. It's just fighting. It's full on.
It's still pretty graceful that they can do what they do, I suppose.
Oh, it's just astonishing.
Yeah.
Absolutely astonishing. Apparently one guy, one of the stuntmen, fell 5 metres. He was supposed to fall in the scene, but he missed the crash mat because the wire snapped. Got knocked out for 10 minutes, taken off to hospital for 4 days, and then came back and cracked on with the next scene.
Tough.
So, some hard men involved in making this film, but... Mm.
Well, that all shows on screen. So yes, go see it, but, don't be disappointed because you'll love it. So go love it.
Yeah, it feels like we're trying to downplay expectation now, but it is terrific. There's nothing to dislike.
but don't go in thinking there's nothing
to dislike.
Don't
go looking for things to dislike because everyone said it's terrific.
Okay.
It is very, very violent.
That's a complicated point.
We should make that point.
It's an 18. It's full-on violent. So, if you don't like... If you want hammers to be used for, proper DIY tasks rather than...
Death.
Yeah, this is not the film for you, but it is awesome.
Yeah. Okay. And that's not the only film out this week, of course. Most column inches this week in every newspaper in the country, it seems, have been devoted to the return of Sacha Baron Cohen in his new film, The Dictator. So what do we think of this?
I feel sort of reaching the point with Bruno that it's kind of like a bit of enough with Sacha Baron Cohen to a point. The whole kind of persona thing for me, but I mean, in that film, it had the tastelessness, but didn't have... And it had some funny bits, but not enough of them to warrant his kind of...
Schtick.
Assault. Yeah, it's kind of an assault on good taste. And we don't necessarily want good taste from him at all, but we do want funny. And this film, I think, brings a bit of that back, which is kind of nice. And... Bruno seemed to be maybe running out of ideas. This is very different. This is more sort of coming to America than a kind of agit doc type star that he's had with these characters before.
I think what he's had before, I mean, he was able to go in kind of under the radar and, shock people into giving some kind of honest response to his characters. And I think he's just become too high profile to do that, and he's had too many lawsuits filed against him, and it's just become too difficult. So I think he probably had to go this route. He probably had to go the, scripted film route. And I think, it does succeed, for my money, definitely better than Bruno, but possibly isn't quite as hilarious as Borat, although still really, really as wrong as Borat, I would say.
You're right about Bruno. I think that was part of the problem, that people did sort of know who he was by that point. So
I think the problem with Bruno is it was a weak character. It was... Yeah. I think he was pointing the finger in the wrong direction. With Borat, he was... It was laughing at people's own kind of... prejudices about something, but it felt like more with Bruno as if he was bringing prejudices and kind of saying it wasn't as smart as Borat was. It was very obvious.
I think it started off well. It started off lampooning the fashion industry and the whole circus of like that side of media, and that bit was good enough. But you're right, after that it suddenly he just sort of was laughing at other people, laughing at middle America again, which is just an easy target for him. I think.
I think there's a question of smartness over this one a little bit as well, because while it is, there's some very funny things that in there about sort of foreign policy, about the paranoia in the West, about the sort of Middle East, and its rulers and its mores and its whatever. At the same time, it's not quite clear who it's attacking. I don't think always, you know, it's clear that the dictator himself is not a nice person, but at the same time, we're almost supposed to root for him for parts of the film, and it's a bizarre mix for me. It didn't feel very focused in its targets a little bit.
Yeah. Well, maybe part of what he's trying to do is just say, you'd like to ask him, but he obviously doesn't talk out of character that much. So, but maybe it's to say, actually, everything's a little bit crazy in terms of the whole, you know, war on terror, blah, 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 I think.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that comes attitudes, through in the
attitudes
sort of,
and paranoia are sure. Just, you know.
I think that comes through late in the film, and he's clearly, you know, he's poking the West as well as anybody else. And, you know, there is that big scene late on where that's clearly what's happening. I just feel like it's not as focused again, and it's not as kind of driven by a clear, concise view of anything, really. It's just kind of going for gags and poking fun at things.
There's some really funny stuff in it though.
Yeah, very, very
I really enjoy the bit with the when they're in the helicopter flying over New York and they're talking in Arabic about, you know, his new Porsche 911, and all the Americans sitting opposite them can hear is this kind of guy talking about 9/11 and pointing at buildings and doing these kind of like big explosion type noises. So yeah, he is a funny man, and this is perhaps a new direction that you know, could reinvigorate his career.
Phil mentioned the him doing interviews in character. I kind of feel that's part of what's making people a bit tired of this, what seems like a shtick, because he's a really clever comedian and a very good actor of this type. But I'm so bored with him doing stuff in character when he's doing interviews.
Yeah,
it becomes really unfunny. Really,
well, one of my first ever interviews was with him in character as Bruno, and if a day goes by without someone, you know, a friend or whatever, emailing and saying, "I've just watched your interview and I'm still laughing, you look ridiculous." he was, you know, wearing a tiny top hat and wearing the full Bruno shtick and doing it all in character. And it's kind of excruciating to be confronted with, because he's a very funny man, and it was all a little rehearsed, should we say.
I find it a really strange thing that he doesn't. I mean, he has done some. I know he did one with Howard Stern.
Yeah.
I think it was this week. And he's really interesting. He's really engaging and really entertaining. And that kind of sells his movies more for me than him doing stuff that wasn't necessarily good enough to be in the film.
I do agree. I think the publicity blitzes are a bit much sometimes. And also, I mean, what's worth saying actually quickly is that not everything you've seen in all the trailers is actually going to turn up in the film.
Mm-hmm.
There's been enough stuff that they actually had clearly a lot of still very funny outtakes to chuck into the trailers and you know, so it hasn't maybe taken away from the film as much as it might have done in other cases. You know, other cases they put out that many trailers, that many clips, they've basically given away every joke in the film. So that's not the case here, you'll be glad to see. But it is, you know, yeah, a lot of publicity. So maybe try and again let the hype leave you as you leave this, as you enter the cinema to see this and judge it on its own merits. Empire gave this 3 stars, right?
That's correct.
So we liked it, but maybe not quite as much as we loved, say, Borat. Also out this week is 2 Days in New York. Now that sees Julie Delpy writing and directing and starring in a sequel to 2 Days in Paris. And this time her character's family visits her new home in New York, and they cause all manner of romantic chaos in a very witty and smart comedy that we gave 4 stars. There's also The Source, which is a kind of a gritty rom-com, if that isn't a complete, you know, contradiction, that we gave, that we liked. It's about a village full of women who withhold sex from their husbands until those husbands agree to help them carry water from the distant well that is their only supply in the village. And that got 3 stars. And if that doesn't float your boat, Powell and Pressburger's classic, The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, is reissued on the big screen this week. And if you haven't seen that, you really, really should. That is a nailed-on 5-star classic that is both comic and tragic. And even by the standards of Powell and Pressburger, is one of their best films. So check it out. So that's your lot for this week's podcast. Next week, we'll be talking to Gareth Evans about The Raid. And we'll be looking at the return of Men in Black 3, the return of Wes Anderson in Moonrise Kingdom, and the return of the large ensemble kind of rom-com in What to Expect When You're Expecting. If you miss us in the meantime, you can head over to the website at empireonline.com or buy a copy of the magazine. It has James Bond on the cover and is well good inside. And with that, the only thing left to do is to say goodbye to Ollie.
Goodbye.
Goodbye to Phil.
Goodbye.
And goodbye from me. Thank you for listening.
I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.